welcome to Be Bold America. I'm your host, Jill Cody. Be Bold America is a live bi-weekly talk show for those who are motivated to step out with the bold actions necessary to reunite this country, fight for democracy, and learn what they can keep doing, stop doing, and start doing to return to our democratic republic. Our future depends on it. Our program today is Strong Men, Why Authoritarian Leaders Succeed and How They Fall. Dr. Ruth Ben-Gayat's new book, Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present, is the first book to place Donald Trump in the context of a century of authoritarianism. Knowing that Donald Trump uses the same playbook as past rulers, corruption, machismo, propaganda, and incitements to violence, has allowed Dr. Ben-Gayat to forecast his actions, including the possibility he would refuse to concede the election. And, as we've seen, he hasn't. As Dr. Ben-Gayat once told Don Lemon on CNN Tonight, once authoritarians get into office, it's very difficult to get them out. We have big things to do. Dr. Ruth Ben-Gayat is a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University, is an award-winning author and political commentator on fascism, authoritarian leadership, and propaganda. She's received the Guggenheim, Getty, Library of Congress, NEH, and other fellowships, and she offers historically informed analysis of current events in regular columns for CNN.com, The Washington Post, and on radio, podcasts, and television. Her new recently published book is Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present. Follow her on Twitter at Ruth Ben-Gayat. That's Ruth, R-U-T-H, Ben, B-E-N, Gayat, G-H-I-A-T. And welcome back to Be Bold America, Dr. Ben-Gayat. It is a pleasure to have you on the program again.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
I'm glad you're here, too. Ruth, to get us all on the same page, would you start us out with some definitions? What is authoritarianism, fascism, and strongman? And is totalitarianism the same as authoritarianism?
So I see authoritarianism is at its most basic. It's a system of government where the executive and the figure of the leader comes to dominate and often crush the judicial branch and all the other branches of government. And in the 20th century, you often ended up with a one-party state, a kind of dictatorship, right? And there was no opposition, and you still have this grand under communist states in North Korea and in China and elsewhere. And totalitarianism was a term that was used especially in the Cold War, but Mussolini invented it to refer to fascism as a total system of government where he famously said nothing outside of the state should be allowed to exist. So again, this kind of crushing state power that erodes private versus public, and you know doesn't allow for any individuality, any dissent, and so you had Nazism and communism, which Stalinist communism. So those are just some definitions, and I'm using in my book. I use the word strongman to refer to it, a kind of authoritarian leader, and they're different. There are different phases of authoritarianism. So I cover the fascist era and then the time of military coups and the Cold War. And then I go up to our day where you have what I call new authoritarians, people who come in through elections and then they manipulate elections to stay in power. And strongmen rulers are rulers who destroy or damage democracy, and so they do all the things of authoritarianism, but they also use masculinity as a kind of way to legitimate themselves. It's very important in their presentation to their people and in their relationships with other leaders. So a strongman is like a subset of an authoritarian leader.
Ah, that's very interesting. And in the authoritarian playbook, you've mentioned that the authoritarian or strongman uses corruption and machismo, propaganda, incitement to violence. violence, but you also add virility in your book. I remember Trump, after his helicopter return from the hospital, standing on the White House balcony, very much Mussolini-like manner, for what seemed a very long time, you know, ripping off his mask and puffing his chest. Is that what you mean by having to show virility?
Yeah, the body, so I used a lot of political science studies and data sets and things, but I also wanted to elevate machismo and virility to a kind of tool of rule alongside corruption and propaganda and these other things. And the body of the ruler, the way he presents himself to his people, how he becomes a kind of anchor for them, the kind of leader-follower relationship, is really important, and Trump has always understood this very, very well. So when he, that's an interesting episode. So, you know, the backstory is that he'd gotten COVID,
right,
and his followers are very worried about him, and then he made this kind of miraculous recovery, very speedy recovery, and this also played into the idea that you see from Mussolini to Trump, that the strongman is somebody who is a man above all other men. So he can do things that lesser men can't do, like survive COVID. And he's also there by the will of God, some believe, to, you know, save the nation. And in Trump's case, you have evangelical Christians and some Orthodox Jews who present this point of view. So Trump understands really well what is expected him and what he represents for his followers, so that I was really interested in this episode. So he gets out of the hospital and he goes up the stairs to this balcony area, which was hard for him. He was breathing hard because he'd just come out of the hospital.
Right, and you could see that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, but he's very good about political theater. He understands how important political theater is. So he goes up to this balcony, you've got the flags, and he just stands there, he rips off the mask, but he stands there and doesn't say anything, and he lets people look at him. And I read that as him understanding that people need to see that he's still their rock.
Ah.
That he is well, that he is a Superman. And in fact, his followers were posting memes around Facebook of his supposed x-rays, and what you would see in the x-ray was a Superman sign. So he gets it just as much as Mussolini got it in his day.
Well, I also read somewhere that he played around with the idea of having a Superman T-shirt on when he left the hospital and rip open his shirt. Did you hear about that too?
I did, and what was interesting about that is that with Trump, you know, normally the leader and his government make the propaganda points, and then they disseminate them to the state machinery, right? But in Trump's case, he is very influenced by what is circulating both from Fox News. Like, there's been lots of documentation that many of his talking points were said on Fox News, which he's watching TV like 8 hours a day, right?
Right.
So there'd be a quote or a point of view on Fox News, and then he would parrot it. He, the president, would parrot it. So in the same way, his followers had already been posting these memes, including tweeting it to him, of this Superman business. So I wouldn't be surprised if he got this idea from them, because these circuits of kind of propaganda are very, he knows how to do that. He's a marketer, and he picks up things that are in the air.
It's like a Mobius strip. It just keeps continuing back and forth and around.
Exactly.
You're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM. Many voices, one station. Listen worldwide online from the KSQD.org homepage. Catch up on previous Be Bold America programs by visiting the KSQD webpage, or subscribe to our podcast by using your favorite podcast platform. I'm your host, Jill Cody.
KSQD thanks the following donors who support our wonderful programs with their recurring monthly contributions: Dean Silvers, Jim Smith, Carla Sona, Eileen Sundet, and Michael Tanner. You inspire us to give you our very best at 90.7 FM. May you also inspire others to donate on our website, ksqd.org.
Today, our topic is Strong Men, Why Authoritarian Leaders Succeed and How They Fall. We're speaking with Dr. Ruth Ben-Gayet, author of several award-winning books, the most recent of which is Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present, that is now a number one Amazon bestseller. Follow her on Twitter at Ruth Ben-Gayet. And after reading your book, Ruth, I would think right now, and to January 20th, if not longer, is the most dangerous time for our democracy. Is that right? I think we're in very troubled waters right now.
It is, because, when I had to finish the book, I had to turn it in July, and I had time to write about the Black Lives Matter protests, but I didn't know how the election would go. But I knew, and I'd already made the argument throughout the book, that Trump is of the same personality as many of the other leaders I chronicled. Now, the outcome is different. We're not in a fascist dictatorship today, but the personality is the same. And so one of the most interesting chapters I wrote was the endings chapter, like basically how do you get rid of them? You know, what happens to them? And one commonality is that their arrogance and their brutality and the way that they surround themselves with family and flatterers means that they don't want to accept reality, and they continue on in this fictional reality, and so they're not suited to be driven out of office. And that's why they meet a bad end. Some you know, are killed, and some go into exile. And so Trump, being of the same temperament, it was obvious to me that whatever happened, he wouldn't go quietly. So one of the last things I read about him in the book, and this is July, was never underestimate his tenacity or his willingness to do anything possible to stay in power. Mm-hmm. So what we're seeing now with him trying to contest, you know, election results that has been very unsuccessful. I think he was looking at a military option, which is why I was very relieved that the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Milley, out of the blue, made this declaration that the armed forces will obey the Constitution and not an individual. So you must ask yourself why he felt the need to say that.
I remember so that. I was very, was calmed by that.
Yeah, and he said that probably for a reason.
Yes.
So that's not you know, at least the regular armed forces, that's not going to go well. But so the issue is more that these men, they're very vindictive, and if they can't have power, they want to drag the country down with them. And so Trump is pursuing this strategy of trying to wreck things as much as possible so that Biden will have an absolutely impossible time governing, both in terms of worsening coronavirus and destabilizing foreign relations and, you know, not granting transition powers. This is pure vindictiveness, and this is very typical for this kind of leader.
Well, you did say in your book that the authoritarian playbook has no chapter on failure.
They're the most surprised of all that they're going down every time.
Well, getting to another, I think might relate to what you're talking about, but getting to another definition, earlier this month you had an article published in the Washington Post titled Strong Man Leaders Take Defeat Poorly, as we were just talking about, just like Trump. Mm-hmm. And you talk about Trump didn't have time to completely dismantle our American democracy, but that he did have time to install personalist rule. What is personalist rule?
Yeah, so this is a kind of governance where everything revolves around the leader, who has a very proprietary conception of governance, meaning he thinks that people serve him and not the other way around. And everything comes to revolve around his personal obsessions, his personal agendas, his personal financial needs, his legal troubles. So most commonly you see this with old school authoritarians, but it can also happen in people who, like Trump, don't destroy democracy all the way. And I have a very important precedent of Silvio Berlusconi in Italy in the early 2000s. And he succeeded. He was a total personalist ruler. He owned TV networks. He such conflicts of interest. He never gave up family ownership of the TV networks while he was the head of state. But he had so many legal troubles, the amount of lawsuits, only Trump rivals the amount of lawsuits. So when he was accused of bribery, he passed a law, he got a law passed that made bribery a lesser offense. And he had dozens of these, they were called ad personam laws, like laws made for his personal situation. So that's a good example of personalist rule. And so if the leader has legal troubles, like Trump, then governance, a lot of time and effort is spent by the government and by his party, like the GOP, trying to defend him, smearing his enemies, you know, supporting his corruption. So one, in this case, in this kind of rule, one, the character of that one, you know, individual matters a huge amount to the functioning of the country.
Wow. Well, you know, one of the strategies I'm seeing that he and Rudy Giuliani and his so-called legal team is something that I've seen with the climate crisis world. I also wrote a book on climate abandoned. We're on the endangered species list, so I'm also very interested in the climate crisis and what has and has not been happening. And one of the things, one of the strategies of manipulating people is the product of doubt. And when doubt's a product, people that use that don't have to present evidence, data, studies, facts. Just sort of throw boiled spaghetti on the wall. And it started with the chemical industry in the 50s, and then the tobacco industry used it because it worked so well. And then it was utilized to confuse and polarize people with a climate crisis. And now it's being used, I see, to create doubt in the presidential election, where Rudy spots out Venezuela and Cuba and Spain, when in court he actually tells the truth by saying, you know, he's not charging voter fraud, but out in the public he's saying Venezuela was part of it and Spain, and just throwing all this boiled spaghetti everywhere. Do you see this product of doubt as one of the strategies to confuse his people and have them think he's still president after Biden is in?
Yeah, absolutely, and it's really scary. The polls just a few days ago said that, you know, more than 50% of Trump voters thought that the election had been stolen from Trump. And here we come up against the cult of victimhood, which is very, very important, and all of them have this cult of victimhood. Mussolini had it. And so they don't just represent the nation, they embody the nation. So any attacks on, if you're a dissenter or a protester, you're attacking not just, you know, the nation, you're attacking them personally. And this is, goes with the personalist rule. And so this cult of victimhood is really important right now for Trump to save face. He's always been a victim, the deep state, all these conspiracy theories. But the only way, because it seems like, you know, judicial strategy isn't working. So at some point, it's looking more likely, I hope I'm correct, he will have to leave. And then he'll carry with himself the 70 million souls and the personality cult, but also the victimhood thing, because that's very important to his popularity. And so what's interesting about this kind of strongman is that, of course, they're the alpha male. So I talked before about the body is like he's their rock. But they also are, with the victimhood complex, they also make people very protective of them. And this works with women too. That's why it's one of the reasons that all of these guys have a lot of female voters, even though they're hardly friendly to women's rights, and they're sexist, and they're, you know, they're just not feminist people at all. But women are wild about them, and women feel protective of them because poor Trump, he's the victim.
Well, so you just answered a huge question that I've always had: is why women support Trump and vote for him after what he's done with, you know, ripping babies from mothers' arms and caging children. I could never see why any woman would vote for someone whose administration would do that.
Well, it's what I said before, but it's also racism because women who are white are made to feel superior to not just women of color, but men of color too. And so this, so I have a chapter in the book that's called A Greater Nation, which looks at how they create these communities of the included and the excluded, and how racism has been used for, you know, 100 years to do this. But if you are part of the included community, you're superior as a woman even to a man who's not white in this case.
Ah.
So that's also going on. So you have the attachment to Trump. You have racism. You have then intersects with things like if you're evangelical, you believe he's there to save the nation. All the other, you know, aspects of it, and it's a very potent cocktail.
Well, you mentioned just a little while ago about strong men embody the country, and I read in the book that strong men fear and loathe their people. So how does that work? How does that manifest if they fear and loathe their people, yet they embody the country? Is that really then, therefore, they fear and loathe themselves?
Yeah, it's a very sad thing because people find out too late how much these rulers despise them, and they despise them in the, it's a dynamic that is common to other kinds of abusers and bullies. The more you give up your power to them and worship them, the less they think of you. So they need you, but they despise you. But the problem is the personality cult and the propaganda makes people believe in them, and they don't find out that how destructive their leaders are that they love so much and how they despise them, for example, by letting them die of COVID, by being very open about not caring. I mean, I've been saying this since March, and it sounds very harsh, but Trump couldn't care less if you live or die. He's not interested in public welfare. He's not interested in good governance. And people haven't figured that out yet. Enough people figured it out to some changed from voting for Trump to Biden, but Trump also got more votes than he did in 2016.
I know, that was shocking. After four years.
Well, this is the effect of propaganda. It works. It really works.
Well, that leads into a question that I do have. And right now, if you're just joining us, you're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM. Our topic is Strong Men, Why Authoritarian Leaders Succeed and How They Fall. We're speaking with Dr. Ruth Ben-Gayat, author of several award-winning books and who was featured in the recent excellent documentary, Unfit, The Psychology of Donald Trump. I'm your host, Jill Cody.
Hi, I'm Tom Hartman, your host for Progressive Talk on KSQD 90.7 FM, community radio for the Central Coast, 4 p.m. weekdays. KSQD is a vital media resource for listeners in Santa Cruz and Monterey counties and worldwide on the web. Please help support this station by making a contribution to keep the station thriving. Go to ksqd.org and give what you can to help keep shows like mine coming to you daily at 90.7 FM. You know, with six large corporations owning most of the media, it's essential that listeners support grassroots, locally run radio stations like KSQD. Community radio is responsive to its listeners and isn't afraid to challenge the status quo. Please join me, Tom Hartman, in supporting KSQD 90.7 FM, community radio for the Central Coast, by making your pledge today online at ksqd.org. That's 90.7 FM, KSQD. Catch me right here at 4 o'clock this afternoon. Thank you, and tag, you're it.
Now, back to our bold and impressive guest, Dr. Ruth Ben-Gayat. Now, just before the break, Ruth, you were slipping right into a question I had about propaganda. Harry Cheadle, in his What Went Wrong blog, stated that Trump proved how gullible America really is and that Americans will believe literally anything. And I thought I'd ask you to define propaganda because it seems like it really works, doesn't it?
Yeah, it does. I mean, a definition is, you know, it's hard to have an exact definition of propaganda, but it's, you know, information that's purposely manipulated and distorted because it's serving some kind of ideological or political agenda. And one of the interesting things, so each of the chapters, each of the tools of rule has a chapter, and they each go over 100 years. So the reader can see for propaganda, for example, what has changed and what stays the same. So some of the principles haven't changed at all. You need, you know, repetition, and Trump's been excellent with his Twitter feed of hammering home. Think how many times has he said witch hunt, harassment, and he comes from, you know, entertainment and marketing, and so he has slogans. And this is also a commonality of Mussolini was a journalist. He was excellent with slogans. So was Mobutu in the Congo. So the men who have success in this area are often very skilled in media. So you have repetition. Then you have saturation. The message has to be like cross. Today we say, you know, cross different media platforms. But in the, at the beginning, in 100 years ago, it was radio, newsreels, you know, print media, school books for children, and the same message has to be synchronized, and that's another word that they used to use that still applies, right? So the Trump administration and Fox News was its, you know, echo, a nice feedback loop with Fox News. They succeeded in hammering home these talking points to an extent that people really came to believe them.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, getting back to the climate crisis, too, you know, it is an existential threat. And why did Trump not recognize it when his strongman ego should have been, he could have been the savior of the world as he would have thought of it for himself? How, you know, why didn't he see the climate crisis as something that he could be a strong man to be that savior for the world?
Because Trump did not he did not come to power to govern in any traditional democratic sense, and that includes public welfare or welfare of the world. He was there for reasons that are fit in with authoritarian reasons. He was there to make money for Trump Organization, and that's all the golfing. It's not that he's lazy. He's working really hard to go one out of every 3 days he's been in office. He goes to a Trump branded property. So his job is promoting Trump, using the public office of presidency to promote private. Then his other goal is plunder and looting, and here's where the climate comes in. It was very sad when I did the research that, you know, over 100 environmental regulations have been rolled back under Trump to please big agriculture and big pharma and all of, you know, and the coal industry, all of these constituencies that back him. And in fact, right now, he's scurrying around to do the last possible amount of damage. They're trying to rush through more oil drilling licenses in Alaska. And so he never would have wanted to be the savior because he's not interested in altruism. He's only interested in making money and making money for his cronies so they'll keep him in office. So I really think that and this is why the media didn't, we've never had a dictatorship, we've never had a foreign occupation, all we know is democracy. So it makes sense that everybody would have approached Trump with a democratic frame of reference, but he's never been there to govern in a democratic manner. So of course he would never have, it never would have passed through his mind to be a savior in that way, because that implies doing something good for the country and instead of sucking its lifeblood out and making money off of it. It sounds harsh, but that's just, they're all like this, and I show this in the book. He's at the end of every chapter, and when you put him in this context, I mean, I became more alarmed as I wrote the book.
I became more alarmed as I was reading it, too.
Yeah, it ends on a hopeful note,
yes.
But It is grim at times.
Well, and I also have been, for the first time I learned the phrase, and I've heard it on television, is stochastic terrorism, that Donald Trump is responsible for stochastic terrorism You know, that he's not killed anybody directly himself, but he's publicly demonized people and groups enough to incite violence and action, you know, violent acts where other people kill others because of what he's said and done. Mussolini never killed anyone himself, but yet they're terrorists, aren't they?
Yeah, and I don't use that term in the book, but it's a very good. I say that they get other people to do their dirty work,
and then
one of the things is that whether you're a torturer or you're a money launderer who serves them, when he doesn't have any use for you anymore, he boots you out. So he turns on everyone, and we just saw this today with that the lawyer Jenna. I'm not remembering her last name.
Oh, right. I don't remember her last name either.
She's out. Yeah, because she was in and out in the blink of an eye. But this is a small example of larger. And look at Michael Cohen, his personal lawyer. There's a whole history of the personal lawyers of these people, who end up going like everyone around them ends up going to jail, but they don't go to jail.
Right, we're seeing
they
that.
They use people.
Yes.
They use people. And the same with the violence. They know just how to hint if they're in a democracy like Trump, and if they're a fascist, they're overseeing genocide, right? I mean, Mussolini had genocide in Libya. It's a story not many people know about. And of course, Hitler had, you know, the Holocaust. But they're whatever situation they're in, they know how to incite other people to commit acts of violence in their name.
Well, what terrifies me about the future of our democracy, then even more than Trump's presidency, is the total abandonment of the Republican Party in Congress to ever hold him responsible. And even Mike Lee, Representative Mike Lee, I think from Utah, said that democracy is not the point. And if you give me a minute to set up this question, I had read last week an article that Leonard Pitts wrote for the Miami Herald. He's a columnist for the Miami Herald. And he, among other points that he made, he said, well, in the wake of last week's defeat and his refusal to concede, is Trump who stands naked before us, revealed for anyone who inexplicably still harbored doubt as the liar and loser he always was. He rages against math, excoriates voting, raves about imaginary schemes to steal a victory he never won. His psychopathy is nude, his disconnect from reality is disrobed. His toxic narcissism stands bare-cheeked before us all, and you wait for the whispers, and there is silence. Almost no one has found the courage to publicly say the truth. And his Republican Party, I think only four now have even whispered that there's something that he should be acknowledging, that he's no longer president. So, you know, how does he have this grip on the Republican Party?
I wrote an essay in the New York Review of Books that goes into more detail on this point than I do in the book, and it's called Co-opt and Corrupt, How Trump Broke the GOP. And so on the one hand, the GOP was already drifting in an authoritarian direction and in a lawless direction. There were many state representatives who were posing for their Christmas cards with assault rifles. There's a lot of lawlessness going on in that party. And Trump kind of arrived to complete their liberation from democracy. And some comparative politics studies have come out that put the GOP in the framework of international parties, and it actually lines up for its rhetoric and its platforms with far-right parties, like Modi's party, Erdogan's party in Turkey. So they are not interested, many of them, in a democratic political culture anymore. And then they've got this Trump cult, and some people say, okay, he's blackmailing them, he's intimidating them, and the intimidation is real, because after when the Senate acquitted him, Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown went around and interviewed his Republican colleagues, and they all told him off the record that they acquitted Trump because they were afraid. So we're now in the 21st century, so like when, you know, ministers, when ministers got in trouble with Mobutu or with Kyi, they would be sent to jail or killed. Here, that's not happening. Like Jeff Sessions, who stood up against Trump, and now he doesn't have a Senate seat anymore. That's what happens to them. So there's fear. It's something else that I talk about in the book. We like to think that, you know, this authoritarianism attracts people who want to follow orders and be told what to do and have the leader. But it's also a process where some people feel liberated by a lawless leader who tells them there are no limits. And that's what Trump was. He broke all the rules. He talked about shooting people. He says the unsayable. He does the unthinkable. And so there have been people, like, I think this is the secret with Lindsey Graham, in part, who was kind of had this upstanding code of behavior and, had this image of being kind of upstanding. And he didn't like Trump for those reasons. And then he totally turned, and he's Trump's biggest fan. So some people say it's blackmail, but I think it's also the thrill of serving somebody who is a transgressor, who tells you can do anything and get away with it. And I think that's going on with the GOP, too.
So that freedom is seductive in a way on an individual level.
Yeah, I think that. And I think for William Barr, too.
Ah.
I think that's important for William Barr.
Well, I've been saying that we have a two-party system, the Democratic Party and the Anti-Democratic Party. And it seems that what you're saying, that the Republican Party's been leaning authoritarian for quite a while. Now, to me, it's obvious that we have an anti-democratic party because we're not having a smooth transition of power, which is a fundamental of our democracy. And they're obvious and intense and completely open about their desires for voter suppression and theft and not counting on the votes. And voting is also a primary tenet of democracy. So it just seems like there are two parties. One is democratic and one is anti-democratic.
Yeah, and this is something we have to reckon with. What do we do? When Trump can be gone, and hopefully there won't be Trump mini Trumps back, like Ivanka. But the GOP is the one who enabled him from the start and the one that remains. And they're a lawless party.
Mm-hmm.
So this is something we'll have to reckon with, and that's why it's not all about Trump, right?
Right. Well, I think something that is, saving us is that Trump is not very smart, but I'm very afraid of somebody coming in that is a fascist who is smart, and then we could really be in trouble. What thoughts do you have on the role of Fox News and Breitbart and Limbaugh, One American Network, Newsmax, and the elevation of strongmen in our society? It seems to me that, in my view, Roger Ailes was a strong man, maybe Rupert Murdoch, definitely Rush Limbaugh, because he had said years ago, the four pillars of deceit was academics, government, media, and science, which just cuts his listeners away from any knowledge.
Yeah. I mean, I'm reserving the word strongman for heads of state.
Ah, got it. Okay.
But
authoritarians,
but
then.
Mm-hmm.
Got it. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and the program that Trump simply legitimized and elevated all of these things, these anti-science, these conspiracy theories, all of these things that already circulated in the right-wing media universe. He gave it a presidential authority. And that's also true of violence and all of these things that are very anti-democratic. And throughout history, and this is what the book shows, it shows these patterns that when these guys come on the scene, they they energize and legitimate existing anti-democratic and extremist tendencies. It's like they give them a focus, and then they make these movements. And remember, Trump's was a movement, right? Mm-hmm. He always said it was a movement, and then he was very smart with the marketing, and everybody had their red caps, so they become a tribe.
Mm-hmm.
That's part of the movement. And so they take what's already there, and they soup it up. They accelerate it, and they give it. And then if they become head of state, then it becomes state policy. So right wing and Fox News, they prepared the way for the mentality that then became part of the presidential brand, let's say.
Well, and you talked about inciting violence. I just recently read that hate crimes are at their highest level in a decade.
Yeah.
And hate-motivated killings are the highest since the FBI began collecting the data in 1990, 30 years.
Yeah, and this was true from the start. In 2016, the study didn't come out till 2019, but I cited in my book that counties that had Trump rallies during, the campaign, they saw an enormous, I've forgotten the percentage, but a huge spike in violence. Like only those counties at the time. So it was a direct result of people leaving, getting all kind of jacked up on hatred from Trump's rallies and what he was telling them, and then going out and being violent and having targets if he just told them that Muslims were bad or migrants were bad. So this is, again, goes back to the terroristic aspect, right?
Right.
The incitements to violence.
You're listening to Be Bold America on KSQD 90.7 FM, many voices, one station. Listen globally online from the KSQD.org homepage, or listen to the show's podcast at KSQD.org, Be Bold America's webpage. I'm your host, Jill Cody.
Buddhism, Judaism, Baha'i, Islam, Christianity, Hinduism. Sound interesting? Faith Matters is a unique bi-monthly program that explores spirituality, life, and meaning with local religious leaders. We discuss areas of common ground and also identify distinct differences among diverse spiritual perspectives. Join us on the second and fourth Sunday evening of every month from 6 to 7 as we have thought-provoking conversations about Faith Matters on 90.7 KSQD.
Today, our topic is Strong Men, Why Authoritarian Leaders Succeed and How They Fall. And we're speaking with Dr. Ruth Ben-Gayat, author of the number one Amazon bestseller, Strong Men, Mussolini to the Present. Follow her at Twitter at Ruth Ben-Gayat. And Ruth, how do strong men fall?
So most of them, there's some have to forced into exile, some they have popular protests. This happened, of course, with the fall of communism. In Libya, there was a popular revolution influenced by the Arab Spring. But here, too, the destructiveness, because Gaddafi said, "I'll never surrender," and he preferred to drag his country into a civil war. Pinochet, who was a Chilean dictator, was one of the very few to get voted out. And he spent the next year before he left office trying to sabotage the new democracy. Sounds familiar.
Mm-hmm.
But we have, when you look at the history of this this terrible traumas and destruction they visit on their people, you're doubly appreciative of what we have done by voting Trump out, because I believe he was on his way to consolidating everything in a not good direction. And we've been one of the few peoples in history who have stopped this authoritarian building up or state capture process and kind of reversed it or turned it back by voting. So we should feel really, really good about that.
That is inspiring. In the last few minutes, what could listeners keep doing, stop doing, start doing as they relate to this topic, Ruth? What should listeners be doing to fight authoritarianism and fascism and understanding how they can keep their democracy?
I think, promoting science, and especially for now we are in the middle of a pandemic, I think reaching out to people you know who might support Trump, because there's a core of people who will never listen to anything, right? They're just wedded to him. But there are other voters who may have been situational voters, or, for example, maybe they didn't really like Trump, but they were mistakenly told by propaganda that Biden was going to ruin the earth, that Biden was going to cause socialism and, you know, anarchy. And so these people, when Biden comes in and they see that everything is not falling down to pieces, there's not going to be anarchists and, you know, foreign rebels coming in, all of these myths, you can reach out to them. That's one thing you can do. In terms of stop doing, if you've still been following Trump and retweeting him and mocking him, you could stop doing that. Stop making him the center of your attention. I've been advocating that since 2017, and start doing build on the election. What I just said, the accomplishment that we have to protect democracy, because we can't take this for granted. These people are still—they're already planning for 2024. So, you donate or volunteer to civil rights societies, anti-corruption. Voter protection, that's going to be, we may think we can relax, but actually it's exposed how fragile things are, and I think that we need to be, just as we take our vitamins every day and we go about our errands, we need to do something to protect democracy every day.
Mm. Well, you mentioned socialism, and one thing that I hear from Republican friends and acquaintances is that they're just barraged with the fear of socialism. Biden's a socialist. This person's a socialist. Socialism will take over the country. Be very, very afraid. And yet it seems that our real fight would be against fascism. What's the difference between the two?
Well, this is just utter nonsense. I mean, Biden, even they're saying, pearl-wearing Nancy Pelosi is a socialist.
I know.
Pure propaganda. Revolutionary socialism and communism fell in the West. And there are people who are kind of progressive, like Bernie Sanders, who may have certain socialistic impulses, but they work within democracy. So this, it's like a bugaboo. It's just like a scarecrow, this socialism. And the same with Antifa.
Mm-hmm.
It's all linked. It's an attempt to, to make people scared, to erase the center, to say there's no center, there's no liberals, which is, Biden is a liberal. He's not a socialist. And this is a global talking point. It's important to note. My mother lives in a small town in England, and she's been watching Russian propaganda, and she thinks that she lived here for many years in California, where I was raised. But she now thinks that Biden is a socialist, and as soon as, come January, the whole country's going to fall apart, and she calls me worried about anarchists. And I finally said, "What are you watching?" And she said, "RT." And I said, "Mom, this is Putin's propaganda." So it's the same talking point of Putin and Trump, which you shouldn't be surprised at.
No, not surprised.
But it's very powerful for people. Trying to correct that in people who maybe are only 10% receptive is not wasted effort.
And also to people that may just check into our country around elections and then just check out for 2 years and then check in a little bit and check out. And I also think they mix it up with the word social, we have social programs, but they're not socialism, not socialistic. And so, Ruth, as we wrap up, I was really taken with the last few sentences from your book. Would you be so kind as to read them to us?
So it's the very end. What are the lessons of this, century of falling into authoritarianism and then resisting it and coming out of it. So history shows the importance of keeping hope and faith in humanity and of supporting those who struggle for freedom in our own time. We can carry with us the stories of those who lived and died over a century of democracy's destruction and resurrection. They are precious counsel for us today.
They are precious counsel for us today. Thank you, Ruth. I love this discussion, and it's just been, you answered several questions about why women support the strong man, and it was really succinct and concise about what we're facing today and how Trump might fall. I do know that Letitia James and Cy Vance are looking at his tax issues, and I know we got Al Capone on tax evasion, so that may be one way that he will fall. But I am inspired by us voting him out, and I think that's a positive thing to remember. So thank mm-hmm. you, Ruth. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I also want to thank Emily Dunham for being Be Bold America's program engineer today, and give another huge thank you to Dr. Ruth Ben-Gayet, who is professor of history and Italian studies at New York University, who also is an award-winning author and political commentator. Buy her book, Strong Man, Mussolini to the Present, where you can find books sold anywhere. It was an eye-opener for me. Next time on Be Bold America, our topic will be the five real conspiracies you need to know about. The world is awash in dangerous conspiracy theories, but there are five real ones you probably haven't heard of. So join us December 6th at 5 p.m. to hear from Jeremy Lent, founder of the Leology Institute, and whose writings investigate the patterns of thought that have led our civilization to its current crisis of sustainability. Again, that's the five real conspiracies you need to know about December 6th at 5 p.m. Want to listen to the show later? Find a Be Bold America podcast on KSQD's website or subscribe and download it to your electronic device from Apple Podcasts, Anchor FM, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Breakers, Radio Public, Overcast, and Pocket Casts. You're listening to KSQD Santa Cruz, many voices, one station. Listen worldwide online at ksqd.org. Stay tuned for Faith Matters with Seth Shapiro. My name is Jill Cody, and thank you for listening to Be Bold America. Until next time, keep, stop, start,